It's wonderful to be with you this morning. Yesterday, as part of one of the notifications I got, Master went to a dinner that was commemorating Swami Vivekananda's birthday at the time. Of course, he had passed years before that. But it put me in mind of the great master. He was a wonderful personality. I think he and Master had many things in common. And so I wrote about him for the posting, and I'd like to read from that. January 20th, 1929, Swami Yogananda attended a banquet in New York honoring the birth of the remarkable Swami Vivekananda. This brought to my mind the great God-man who preceded Master coming to America by 27 years. Swami Vivekananda was recognized as a prodigious soul by his own guru, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, when he is yet a student at the age of 19. Ramakrishna later told devotees that in one of his visions, he had traveled to the causal realm, where he met an amazing being. He asked that being if he would incarnate here on earth and help him with his mission. Years later, when Vivekananda, then known by his birth name, Narendranath, walked through his door, Ramakrishna recognized him as the great soul he had earlier called to earth. Vivekananda was born to a well-to-do family, but his father died when his son was in college, and it fell to the young man to provide for his mother and 8 siblings. Even in this time of stress, he came to see his master, but it was far from a smooth journey. Vivekananda had a brilliant mind and was very independent. At first, he doubted Ramakrishna's state of realization. Then he went through a time of intellectual doubt and atheism. When other devotees were distressed by Vivekananda's outspoken views, including his doubts, Ramakrishna would comfort them by saying that Vivekananda would never succumb to the temptations of women and gold, that he was one of a rare breed who would never be ensnared by ignorance. By the time his master passed, Vivekananda was keen to become a monk. After some time living with his brother disciples, he struck out on his own and walked the circumference of India. As he traveled south, he had a deep question in his mind. How was he to serve humanity? What was his mission? At the very south point of India, on a rock where the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, and the Arabian Sea meet, he determined to meditate until he had the answer. Without food or water, he sat for days. Suddenly, he had a magnificent vision of his guru and the history of India. He knew what he was here to do. From there, he traveled northward up the east coast, whereas before he had been fairly incognito, now masses of people responded to him. He felt he was going to America to be the first parliament of world religions, which was to open on September 11th, 1893. He came without knowing about or having the kind of recommendations that were required to be a speaker at the parliament. But through an amazing series of events, he was invited to be a speaker. At the end of the first day, he was to give a talk to over 7,000 participants. Several of the speakers before had been rather dull, the audience subdued. The end of a long day is an unenviable time to give a talk. Swamiji was nervous. He prayed before a statue of Saraswati, goddess of learning. He felt his master with him. He started his speech. Sisters and brothers of America, for 2 minutes there is a thunderous standing ovation. From there, speaking engagements were scheduled. A couple of incidents stand out in my memory of the master. One happened when Vivekananda was giving a talk at a church in a small community. A mentally deranged man entered the church and fired a gun at Swamiji. Those in the pews dove for cover as the bullets flew. Meanwhile, Vivekananda stood up front, facing the man without moving. He calmly gazed at the man firing his gun until the gunman ran out of bullets. Another interaction involved a famous man of the times, John D. Rockefeller, one of the richest men in the world. Friends told him that he should meet the extraordinary Indian monk. Rockefeller was strong-willed, independent, and had no intention of doing so. One day, he somehow decided to go see this man of God from India. He came to the house where Swamiji was staying. The butler asked Rockefeller to wait, but he charged past him, and when he entered the study Swamiji was writing, Rockefeller waited. After some time, Swamiji, without raising his eyes, started telling about Rockefeller's life, things that even his closest friends did not know. Then Swamiji told the multimillionaire that the money he had was not his own. God had given him these resources to help others, the poor and the distressed. He finished by saying that he should spend his money for the benefit of society. Rockefeller left as abruptly as he had come. He was not used to people speaking to him that way. About a week later, he returned to the house, entered the study where once again Swamiji was busy writing. Rockefeller put a newspaper on the table that had headlines of a large amount of money he donated to a public institution and said, "There you are. You must be satisfied now. You can thank me for this." Swamiji, who did not lift his eyes, picked up the paper and read. Then he said, "Why should I thank you? Rather, you should thank me for providing the suggestion." Later, this gift of money was followed by other large donations by the millionaire and eventually led to the establishment of the Rockefeller Foundation in 1913, which even now continues its charitable work. Each incident of a person's life is like a puzzle piece that, when put together, builds a picture of the whole person. However, we will never have all the pieces to any one person, much less that of such a highly God-realized soul. The close of Swamiji's life for this incarnation came on the 4th of July, 1902. He started the day by meditating for 3 hours. Then he taught a class on philosophy of yoga to young students, and later led a discussion for the planning of a Vedic college. When he went to his room, he asked not to be disturbed. Swami Vivekananda left the body at 9:20 that night while meditating. Doctors said the cause of death was a burst blood vessel in his brain. Devotees said the blood vessel burst when the master pierced his crown chakra, Brahmaranda, while entering Mahasamadhi. He was 39 years old. His guru had said many years before that once his disciple tasted the full freedom of God, he would in that moment leave the body. I included with this a transcript of a talk, a couple of talks that were combined to be under the title of My Master. And it is Swami Vivekananda talking about his guru, Ramakrishna Paramahansa. It's a wonderful work, and I hope that you'll read it in its entirety. But I wanted to read from it a certain length of his talk, which I think is wonderful. For some years, I read different books by Swami Vivekananda. He wrote one on Karma Yoga, another on Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, and so on. These were fairly philosophical treatises. And they didn't draw me in that much. I came to learn later from Mother that they had been heavily edited and changed, and that may be some of the reason why they didn't draw me in. But in this talk about his own master, I feel that his personality who he is, his relationship with his guru, comes shining forward. So I think it's worth spending some time with it. I pick it up in after he had begun his talk. The character of the father and the mother of my master were very much like that. Very poor they were. And yet many a time the mother would starve herself a whole day to help a poor man. Of them this child was born, and he is a peculiar child from the very boyhood. He remembered his past from his birth and was conscious for what purpose he came into the world. And every power was devoted to the fulfillment of that purpose. While he was quite young, his father died, and the boy was sent to school. A Brahmin's boy must go to school. The caste restricts them to a learned profession only. The old system of education in India is still prevalent in many parts of the country, especially in connection with sannyasins. It is a very different from modern system. The students had not to pay. It was thought that knowledge is so sacred that no man ought to sell it. Knowledge must be given freely and without any price. The teachers who used to take students without charge, and not only so, most of them gave their students food and clothes. To support these teachers, the wealthy families on certain occasions, such as a marriage festival or the ceremonies for the dead, made gifts to them. They were considered the first and foremost claimants to the certain gifts, and they in their turn had to maintain their students. So whenever there is a marriage, especially in a rich family, these professors were invited, and they attend and discuss various subjects. This boy went to one of those gatherings of professors, and the professors were discussing various topics such as logic or astronomy, subjects much beyond his age. The boy was peculiar, as I have said, and he gathered this moral out of it. This is the outcome of all their knowledge. Why are they fighting so hard? It is simply for money. The man who can show the highest learning here will get the best pair of cloth. And that is all these people are struggling for. I will not go to school anymore. And he did not. That was the end of his going to school. But this boy had an elder brother, a learned professor, who took him to Calcutta to study with him. However, a short time the boy became fully convinced that the aim of all secular learning was mere material advancement and nothing more, and he resolved to give up study and devote himself solely to the pursuit of spiritual knowledge. The father being dead, the family was very poor, and this boy had to make his own living. He went to a place near Calcutta and became a priest. To become a temple priest is thought very degrading to a Brahmin. I had not realized that before. Our temples are not churches in your sense of the word. They are not places for public worship. For properly speaking, there is no such thing as public worship in India. Temples are erected mostly by rich persons as a meritorious religious act. If a person has much property, he wants to build a temple. In that, he puts a symbol or an image of an incarnation of God and dedicates it to worship in the name of God. The worship is akin to that is conducted in Roman Catholic churches, very much like the Mass, reading certain sentences from sacred books, waving a light before an image, and treating the image in every respect as we treat a great man. That is all that is done in the temple. The man who goes to temple is not considered thereby a better man than he who never goes. More properly, the latter is considered to be more religious, for religion in India is to each man his own private affair. In the house of every man, there is either a little chapel or a room set apart, and there he goes morning and evening, sits down in a corner, and there does his worship. And this worship is entirely mental, for another man does not hear or know what he is doing. He sees them only sitting there, and perhaps moving his fingers in a peculiar fashion, or closing his nostrils and breathing in a peculiar manner. Beyond that, he does not know what his brother is doing. Even his wife, perhaps, will not know. Thus, all worship is conducted in the privacy of his own home. Those who cannot afford to have a chapel go to the banks of a river or a lake or the sea if they live on the seaside. But people sometimes go to worship in a temple by making salutation to the image. There, their duty to the temple ends. Therefore, you see, it has been held from most ancient times in our country, legislated upon by Manu, that is, a degenerating occupation to become a temple priest. Some of the books say it is so degrading as to make a Brahmin worthy of reproach, just as with education, but in a far more intense sense with religion. There is the other idea behind it, that the temple priests who take fees for their work are making merchandise of sacred things. So you may imagine the feeling of that boy when he was forced through poverty to take up the only occupation open to him, that of a temple priest. There have been various poets in Bengal whose songs have passed down to the people. They are sung in the streets of Calcutta and every village. Most of these are religious songs, and their one central idea, which is perhaps peculiar to the religion of India, is the idea of realization. There is not a book in India on religion which does not breathe this idea. Man must realize God, feel God, see God, talk to God. This is religion. The Indian atmosphere is full of stories of saintly persons having visions of God. Such doctrines form the basis of their own religion. And all these ancient books and scriptures are the writings of persons who came into direct contact with spiritual facts. These books were not written for the intellect, nor can any reasoning understand them, because they are written by men who saw the things of which they wrote. And they can be understood only by men who have ever raised themselves to the same height. They say that there is such a thing as realization even in this life, and it is open to everyone, and religion begins with the opening of this faculty, if I may call it so. This is a central idea in all religions, and this is why we may find one man with the most furnished oratorical powers, or the most convincing logic, preaching the highest doctrines, and yet unable to get people to listen to him. While we may find another man, a poor man, who scarcely can speak the language of his own motherland, yet half the nation worships him in his own lifetime as God. When in India the idea somehow or other gets abroad that a man has raised himself to that state of realization, that religion is no more a matter of conjecture to him, that he is no more groping in the dark in such momentous questions as religion, the immortality of the soul, and God, people come from all quarters to see him, and gradually they began to worship him. In the temple was an image of the blissful mother. The boy had to conduct worship morning and evening, and by degrees this one idea filled his mind. Is there anything behind these images? It is true that there is a mother of bliss in the universe? Is it true that she lives and guides the universe, or is it all a dream? Is there any reality in religion? The skepticism comes to the Hindu child. It is the skepticism of our country. Is this what we are doing is real? And theories will not satisfy us, although they are ready at hand, almost all the theories that have ever been made with regard to God and the soul. Neither books nor theories can satisfy us. The one idea that gets hold of thousands of our people is this idea of realization. Is it true that there is a God? If it can be true, can I see him? Can I realize the truth? The Western mind may think this all very impractical, but to us, it is very intensely practical. For this, their lives. You have just heard how from the earliest times there have been persons who have given up all comforts and luxuries to live in caves, and hundreds have given up their homes to weep bitter tears of misery on the banks of the sacred rivers in order to realize this idea. Not to know in the ordinary sense of the word, not intellectual understanding, not a mere rationalistic comprehension of the real thing, but not mere groping in the dark, but intense realization, much more real than this world is to our senses. That is the idea. I do not advance any proposition as to that just now, but that is the one fact that is impressed upon them. Thousands will be killed, other thousands will be ready. So upon this one idea, the whole nation for thousands of years have been denying and sacrificing themselves. For this idea, thousands of Hindus every year give up their homes, and many of them die through the hardships they have to undergo. To the Western mind, this must seem most visionary, and I can see the reason for this point of view. But though I have resided in the West, I still think this idea the most practical thing in life. Every moment I think of anything else is so much lost to me. Even the marvels of earthly sciences, everything is vain if it takes me away from that thought. Life is but momentary. Whether you have knowledge of an angel or the ignorance of an animal, life is but momentary. Whether you have the poverty of the poorest man in rags or the wealth of richest man living, life is but momentary. Whether you are a downtrodden man living in one of the big streets of the big cities of the West or a crowned emperor ruling over millions, life is but momentary. Whether you have the best of health or the worst, life is but momentary. Whether you have the most poetical temperament or of a cruel mind, there is but one solution of life, says the Hindu, and that solution is what they call God and religion. If these be true, life becomes explained, life becomes bearable, life becomes enjoyable. Otherwise, life is but a useless burden. That is our idea. No amount of reasoning can demonstrate it. It can only make it probable, and there it rests. The highest demonstration of reasoning is that we have in any branch of knowledge can only make a fact probable, and nothing further. The most demonstrable facts of physical science are only probabilities, not facts yet. Facts are only in the senses. Facts have to be perceived, and we have to perceive religion to demonstrate it to ourselves. We have to sense God to be convinced that there is a God. We must sense the facts of religion to know that they are facts. Nothing else and no amount of reasoning but our own perception can take these things real to us, can make my belief firm as rock. That is my idea, and that is the Indian idea. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? We have to sense God to be convinced that there is a God. We must sense the facts of religion to know that they are facts. Nothing else and no amount of reasoning but our own perception can make any of these things real to us, can make my belief firm as rock. That is my idea, and that is the Indian idea. This idea took possession of the boy, and his whole life became concentrated upon that. Day after day he would weep and say, "Mother, is it true that thou existest? Or is it all poetry? Is the blissful mother an imagination of poets and misguided people? Or is there such a reality?" We have seen that of books, of education, in our sense of the word, he had none. And so much the more natural, so much more the healthy was his mind, so much purer his thoughts, undiluted by drinking the thoughts of others, because he did not go to the university. Therefore he thought for himself. Because we have spent half our lives in the university, we are filled with a collection of other people's thoughts. Well has Professor Max Müller said in the article I have just referred to, that this was a clean, original man. And the secret of that originality was that he was not brought up within the precincts of a university. However, this thought, whether God can be seen, which was uppermost in his mind, gained in strength every day until he could think of nothing else. He could no more conduct the worship properly, could no more attend to the various details and all of their minuteness. Often he would forget to place the food offering before the image. Sometimes he would forget to wave the light. At other times he would wave it for hours and forget everything else. And that one idea was in his mind every day. Is it true that thou existest, O Mother? Why cost thou not speak? Art thou dead? Perhaps some of us here will remember that there are moments in our lives when, tired of all these rationalizations, of dull and dead logic, tired of plodding through books, which after all teach us nothing, become nothing but a sort of intellectual opium eating. We must have it at stated times, or we die. Tired of all of this, the heart of our heart sends out a wail. Is there no one in this universe who can show me the light? If thou art, show the light unto me. Why dost thou not speak? Why dost thou not make thyself so scarce? Why send so many messengers and not thyself come to me? In this world of fights and factions, who am I to follow and believe? If thou art God of every man and woman alike, why comest thou not to speak to thy child and see if he is not ready? Well, to us all come such thoughts in moments of great depression. But such are the temptations surrounding us that the next moment we forget. For the moment it seemed that the doors of the heavens were going to be opened. For the moment it seemed as if we were going to plunge into the light effulgent. But the animal man again shakes off all these angelic visions. Down we go, animal man once more, eating and drinking and dying and dying and drinking and eating again and again. However, there are exceptional minds which are not turned away so easily, which once attracted can never be turned back, whatever may be the temptation in the way, which must see the truth, knowing that life must go. They say, let it go to a noble conquest. And what conquest is nobler than the conquest of the lower man, than this solution of the problem of life and death, of good and evil? At last it became impossible for him to serve in the temple. He left it and entered a little wood that was near and lived there. About this part of a life, he told me many times that he could not tell when the sun rose or set, or how he lived. He lost all thought of himself and forgot to eat. During this period, he was lovingly watched over by a relative who put into his mouth food, which he mechanically swallowed. Days and nights thus passed with the boy. When a whole day would pass, toward the end of the evening, the peal of the bells in the temples and the voices singing would reach the wood, and would make the boy very sad, and he would cry, another day gone in vain. Mother, thou hast not come. Another day of this short life is gone, and I have not known the truth. In the agony of his soul, he sometimes would rub his face against the ground and weep, and this one prayer burst forth. Do thou manifest thyself in me, thou mother of the universe. See that I need thee and nothing else. Verily, he wanted to be true to his own ideal. He had heard that the mother never came until everything had been given up for her. He had heard that the mother wanted to come to everyone, but they could not have her. That people wanted to have all sorts of foolish little idols to pray to. That they wanted their own enjoyments and not the mother. And that the moment they really wanted her with their whole soul and nothing else, that moment she would come. So he began to break himself into that idea. He wanted to be exact, even on the plane of matter. He threw away all the little property he had and took a vow that he would never touch money. And this one idea, I will not touch money, became a part of him. It may appear to be something occult, but even in afterlife, when he was sleeping, if I touched him with a piece of money, his hand would instantly become bent, and his whole body would become, as it were, paralyzed. The other idea that came into his mind was that lust was the other enemy. Man is a soul, and soul is sexless, neither man nor woman. The idea of sex and the idea of money were two things, he thought, that prevented him from seeing the mother. This whole universe is a manifestation of the mother. She lives in every woman's body. Every woman represents the mother. How can I think of a woman in mere sex relation? This was the idea. Every woman was his mother. He must bring himself to the state when he would see nothing but mother in every woman. And he carried it out in his life. This is the tremendous thirst that seizes the human heart. Later on, this very man said to me, "My child, suppose there is a bag of gold in one room and a robber in the next. Do you think that that robber can sleep? He cannot. His mind will always be thinking on how to get into the room and obtain possession of that gold. Do you think then that a man, firmly persuaded that there is a reality behind all these appearances, that there is a God, that there is one who never dies, one who is infinite bliss, a bliss compared with which these pleasures of the senses are simply playthings, can rest contented without struggling to attain it? Can he cease his efforts for a moment? No. He will become mad with longing." This divine madness seized the boy. At that time, he had no teacher, nobody to tell him anything, and everyone thought that he was out of his mind. This is the ordinary condition of things. If a man throws aside the vanities of the world, we hear him called mad. But such men are the salt of the earth. Out of such madness have come the powers that have moved the world of ours. And out of such madness alone will come the powers of the future that are going to move the world. So days, weeks, months passed in continuous struggle of the soul to arrive at the truth. The boy began to see visions, to see wonderful things. The secrets of his nature were beginning to open to him. Veil after veil was, as it were, being taken off. Mother herself became the teacher and initiated the boy into the truths he sought. Not only is this a story about his master, Ramakrishna, but it also tells you a great deal about the monk Swami Vivekananda, the way that he thought, the way that he expressed himself. He was a dynamic soul, a powerful soul. And he came with a ton of life energy, and whichever way that life energy ran, he would draw others with him. As was mentioned in the writing, there was a time when he went through an atheistic period. He was not someone to suffer fools lightly. nor was he just to go out on whatever anybody else said. He demanded to know the truth. And this great yearning inside of us, to some extent, makes atheists of us all in the sense that we don't know, but we want to know. We need to know. And that need to know makes us know that we are blind to the underlying reality behind all of this creation. From the moment we open our eyes in the morning to the time that we close them at night, most often we are inundated with the things of the senses. That is why we meditate morning and night. It's a time to set aside this world. What do you do when you go to sleep? You close your eyes. You close your senses off to this world. Most people don't have much awareness of what happens during sleep. Sometimes people will wake up and they'll remember some of their dreams. But there's so much of the time that is completely blank. And yet we wake up feeling refreshed, hopefully, that we have time when we have really rested in deep sleep. As we become more conscious, and as we meditate more deeply, we may be aware of the varying stages that go on when we go to sleep. We close these eyes, and then consciousness is freed from this body, from the things of the senses. And initially, we don't go to the astral worlds. We go to a much deeper place. We go to a much place that is much more still and quiet. And that is where real rest comes from. And it is in this stage of deep sleep that we are most likely to be completely unconscious. And yet there comes a time in our development when we may carry consciousness into that deeply unconscious state, and it is unconscious no more. And we realize that we have, as unconscious yogis, been merging ourselves in with the infinite. That is where real rest comes from. When we are meditating, we are imitating this as we seek to consciously enter into deeper states of rest. Now, in the sleep stage, when we are dreaming, it is called the REM, or the rapid eye movement. The eyes will oftentimes dart back and forth as we are engaged with some dream life. And many times what we call meditation is made up of these imaginings of the mind. Different scenarios come to us, and we live them out. And so we are imitating that state, but we are not dropping to the deeper state. So we have to pass through that lighter sleep state, so to speak, the dream state, in which we are having all kinds of thoughts and imaginings going different places. And we drop into that deeper state of sleep, or samadhi consciousness. And as we touch on that, our minds, fully awake, fully alert, we merge and enter in to a very static, supremely blissful, still, joyful, loving state. Now, being blissful may seem active, but in fact, it is found to be in a completely still state. We have both. It is the state of Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means that you are in touch with the supreme being of your own soul. You know in that state you have always existed. You exist now and you will always exist. That is the state of Sat. And you just know it in the same way that you know that you live in this body, that you go through the day. You just know it. And so in that state, you have a profound realization. There is no birth. There is no death. There is only that supreme state of consciousness and awareness and beingness. But that is not it alone. The second part is Chit. Sat comes first, then Chit. And Chit is consciousness, awareness. And you find that your awareness spreads over all space, Now, this is not an easy concept because most of us are rooted in the body, so we are used to having a particular point of view. This is me, and I identify with this body. Therefore, this is where I reside. This is my name. This is my profession, and so on. It's all in relationship to the things of this body and the things of this world. But in a state of chit, you are consciously aware of much, much more. Not only the eternal state of the soul, but the omniscience, that your mind goes out, and you are not limited to just one individuality of a single being living on this small earth in this spinning galaxy. This is not you at all. It is but an expression of consciousness that has entered into this body. But now you have withdrawn from this body and you know yourself to be so much more. And then the last of these is Ananda. And Ananda is the blissfulness of being. It is not just a still static state, but it is filled with bliss. It is filled with joy. So many people in the body seek out different pleasures. So many people get involved with drugs or other kinds of activities, all seeking to find the real secret to what is lasting joy. I was reading an article about one of the greatest swimmers, Michael Phelps, and he speaks openly about it. But after each one of the Olympics that he participated in, and he's won more medals than anyone else, he would go into a deep depression. And there were times when he thought to take his own life. Now here he is, one of the world's best known personalities, accomplished so many medals. He had so much money coming in because sponsors were lining up to have him as spokesperson or to take his picture and associate them with his products. And yet, with all of that, he would think life is not worth living. And so he went through these periodic states of depression at a time when you would think he would be enjoying the fruits of all of his labors and everything that he had done. And it is like that with us in every soul. We come to a point where life looks dull. It looks like it won't lead anywhere. And I dare say there's nary a person who has not at some point had the thought of just ending it all come into his mind. But as Swami Vivekananda pointed out, that is becomes, for most people, a passing stage. But for some, it becomes a deep yearning. A yearning, a demand to know what is the greater reality if there is one. People who end their lives oftentimes don't entertain that idea that there can be any greater reality. They think this is it. And if this doesn't offer them what they want, then they might as well call it quits. I remember an adult telling me when I was in high school that this is the best life is ever going to get. And you should remember these days because there's nothing better. And I thought, well, I might as well end it now because this isn't so great. But somehow inside of me, I knew that there must be something more. This world didn't seem enough. I couldn't look around and see anyone that I thought, I want to be just like them. It had an emptiness about it, but something inside of me told me that there was more. And then I started reading books about describing what that more might be. But still, it was just a proposition. It was an idea. It was not a reality. Simply reading about it was not enough. I had to explore those worlds. I had to go beyond what this world had to offer. And as was written about and said about Ramakrishna, it's not an easy path. Now, he went through a tremendously difficult sadhana because he had come for that purpose. Even his mother went through a tremendously difficult sadhana, a time that was more than what other people would have to go through to attain that same revelation, that same knowledge of God, because they're not doing it just for themselves, but they're doing it for many others that are to come. But nevertheless, none of us are spared, having to give our all, having to empty ourselves completely and totally, to have that new wineskin. First of all, the old one has to be dissolved. All of our ideas, all of our theories, everything has to be given at the feet of God, have to be emptied out of us, because they're filling the space now. And if the space of the mind and consciousness is filled with our own preconceptions, our own ideas, our own thoughts, then where is the room for new revelations, for things to come in that will make us brand new, rejuvenate us, make us new beings, a new body in Christ, as it says in the scriptures? And so we go through that tremendous emptying out period. And we come to the end of our own strength. Papa says that we do sadhana until we realize that we can never do enough. We empty ourselves into it. We come to the end of our own strength, of our own ability, of our own reasoning. And it is then alone that we are really ready to surrender ourselves, because until then we secretly hang on to our own ideas, to our own attachments. And we come to that point, and we give ourselves totally and completely. And we strive to have that realization, that great enlightenment that has been promised down through the ages. Swami Vivekananda is entirely correct in saying that in India, this is the goal. It's the stated goal. Now, it's not that everybody strives for it, not at all. But down through the centuries, it has been the goal that has been set out in religion. Now, most people take comfort in the rituals, even as they do here. Yet, nevertheless, for somebody such as Ramakrishna, he can strive for that. He can give everything to it. And he will be called mad. He was living in a temple, surrounded by priests. You would think these would be the people qualified to recognize here is a soul who is seeking to go beyond. And yet he was criticized. He was thought to be mad. This is not unusual. Mother, too, was thought to be mad when she was going through her most intense sadhana. So was Papa, so was Madhuchi. There are critics that abound, people who cling to their earthly mode, and they don't recognize what a tremendous challenge this is, what tremendous striving there is. It makes us uncomfortable because it dislodges us from the things that we find comfort in this world. Which of us would want to be thought to be mad by others? You know, it's not an easy thing. You face the criticism. That can stop some people, because they don't want to be seen as different. They don't want to be seen as something that is out of the ordinary, particularly in a negative sense by other people. So you have to surrender that as well. And then we cling on to our own ideas. And God disrupts those. He takes those away from us. And what are we if we are not our thoughts, our ideas, long cherished, long held? And yet these two are taken from us. Then who are we? You see, we have no anchors to hold on to. We lose our bearings completely. This is not an easy thing to go through. But we keep our mind on God. We keep striving and searching. And gradually, as we empty ourselves out, the new wine is poured in to the new wineskin. We have a new body in Christ. We are renewed, and we have that direct perception. Now, the fact that This is not a common thing, does not make it a non-reality. And the fact that common day science today and medicine don't recognize these higher states doesn't make them unreal, only unexplored. One day these will be much more commonly known. It will fill the atmosphere that this is what we strive for. To come in touch with your deeper self. That living only for yourself and only for the things of this world will eventually bring you to despair. That to die to this life will make you truly live. And by trying to cling to this life will make you die. As the great Master Jesus once said. And so true that it is. So let us emulate in the fashion of these great spiritual masters. Let us take inspiration from them, guidance, direction. We don't have to know the answers before we start seeking. That isn't how it works. We have ideas, certainly. That gives us direction. We have methods, and given the means in order to deepen meditation and to go into these states, but none of them substitute for the actual realization that is to come. That must remain forefront in us. Beyond all techniques, beyond all philosophies, what is the truth? Is there a reality behind this reality, or is it only a poetical construct of those who are perhaps not seeking to mislead, but just fanciful? Or is there reality, with a capital R, behind it all? So whether we are far or near, let us strive individually. Let us have that space in our living area that we set up to worship the one God alone. It can be a corner of a room. It can be a whole room if we have that. It can be a space. It can be a chair. But make that a special place. It can be your meditation blanket. And when you enter into the, find the real experience, the reality. Not just putting in your time. Not just putting in your time, but demanding of yourself to know greater bliss, greater realization, to have knowledge that goes beyond reasoning, and as a direct result of your experiences that profound you, that change you so profoundly that you are never the same again. Let us take a few moments and feel the radiant life inside of you. That tingling life force throughout your whole body. Feel in this moment that you are not simply this body. You have a body, but you are not that body. Your existence freely expands beyond simple body consciousness. That you may expand out into the great spheres of creation to become as big as this earth, this solar system, this galaxy and beyond, to feel the freedom of that. To know in that reality that yes, this body was born, but you existed long before that. And one day, you will give up this body and drop it off like you will an old suit of clothes. And you will continue to exist that your vision stretches out over eternity, that there is a stillness and a quiet joy that you are filled with light and in this there is no beginning and no end. This is your home. Not circumference by four walls. Doesn't have a mortgage. Cannot be burned or drowned. Stayed or changed in any way. Because it is your eternal gift, now and always. And no one can give you this knowledge, awareness, and no one can take it away from you. Because when you realize it, you will know that you have always known this on some level. You have always been this. And you dreamed a dream at one time when you felt that it wasn't you. But even then, there is a part of you who knew the truth. And all the urges to explore this world was really a deeply held desire to know God. Become illumined and realized. May the blessings of the infinite God and the Masters ever be with you and lift you into that supreme consciousness. The awareness of who and what you truly are. Om, Amen.